Welcome back to On the Case, the podcast. I'm Paula Zahn, and thanks for joining us for episode 28, Love Lost, Justice Found. Tonight, we're on the case in the suburbs of Salt Lake City, Utah. It was here in the shadows of the snow-capped Wasatch Mountains that a terrifying murder mystery began when a beloved mother and grandmother was killed inside the bookstore she owned. As police sorted through the disturbing clues at the crime scene, one thing became clear. No one in the community would rest easy until the depraved killer of Sherry Black was behind bars. November 30th, 2010. It was just after 1:30 on a cold Tuesday afternoon when the South Salt Lake Police Dispatch received a heartbreaking call from 63-year-old Earl Black.
911, what is the emergency?
Oh, my wife's been murdered. She had a pair of scissors sticking in her and I pulled them out.
Okay, I'm sending the paramedics to help you now.
When emergency workers and police arrived at B&W Billiards and Books, they were met out front by a devastated Earl Black. Officers listened carefully as Earl explained how he had found his wife, Sherry, dead.
I walked into the shop. She's usually out there working on books, but she wasn't there. And that's when I started looking around.
Earl slowly made his way through the aisles of books until he reached the door to the back storeroom. And that's when his nightmare truly began.
I saw some blood around the door. And I opened the door and found her. Never forget it.
Earl gazed down at the love of his life, his wife of 46 years, lying on the floor, the victim of a savage attack. It was obvious that Sherry had been brutally murdered.
Oh boy, if you only knew, it was ugly.
Despite his pain and disbelief, Earl somehow found the composure to call the police.
Well, it took a minute. I was in total shock, of course.
Lieutenant Dwayne Roof.
It was heartbreaking. You could hear the profound pain in his voice.
While Earl was taken outside to be interviewed, police had to put aside their emotions and get to work. Detective Darren Carr.
She had been stabbed numerous times, beat about the head. Her body was in a state of partial undress, and even though the scissors had been removed, they had been right in the center of her chest.
Detective Joe Cetera.
There was blood everywhere. It was horrific.
Crime scene analysts gathered any item that might have been connected to the attack.
We had her clothing. We had a bloody wooden ladder that was next to her head that we thought may have been used as an impact weapon.
There was also a shattered soda bottle found by her body.
An antique orange knee-high bottle that had been broken.
And there was more.
We found an Armani belt that didn't belong to Mrs. Black.
Forensic experts also lifted an unidentified palm print on a bookshelf next to Sherry.
It appears that he was leaning down during the attack and using the bookshelf to hold his weight, and he had actually left a really good palm print.
Police found more blood evidence that documented the killer's movements in the store.
At the threshold of that entryway, there were a number of different maps rolled up and leaned against the wall. We found blood there.
A bloody partial handprint was on a wall right next to a telephone. It looked like he kind of propped himself up.
The blood evidence painted an horrific picture of how the murder had unfolded.
Looked like a blitz attack. It was fast, violent, and he was able to overtake her in a very short time frame.
But it appeared that after the brutal onslaught, the killer had taken his time leaving the store.
You could tell that after the initial attack, he had walked to different parts of the shop. There was blood cast off throughout the shop. There was blood evidence on the door, exiting the door to the shop.
The suspect touched that door as he was leaving the scene.
The totality of the evidence led detectives to conclude the attack had not been well planned.
He hadn't brought in a weapon. He decided to use what was available to him.
Whoever this person was filled with rage and very emotional.
It appeared to have been a crime of opportunity.
We thought as an investigative team that this person was inexperienced. I think whatever monstrous intent he had in his head just took over. This person really clearly wasn't worried about getting caught. The last thing on his mind was, how am I going to get away with this?
The killer had most likely walked into the store and realized that Sherry was alone.
The bookstore at that time would have been open for business.
And with no one else around, he savagely attacked her without any regards for the consequences.
It was damn lucky that someone didn't catch him in the act.
Although Sherry's store sold valuable, rare books, there was no evidence that theft had been the motive.
We felt pretty confident that this wasn't just a robbery gone wrong.
Based on the evidence, the motive was clear.
A violent sex assault homicide.
The gruesome details of the attack on a defenseless older woman added a sense of urgency to the investigation. Detectives sensed if they didn't move quickly, there might be more bloodshed.
I instantly thought this person may do this again.
On the Case, the podcast will continue in a moment. Mental health is something we take very seriously here at On the Case. We believe that taking care of yourself should be a top priority. We also know that finding the right therapist can be tricky, especially one that takes your insurance. If a therapist doesn't take insurance, something as critical as your mental health care can get very expensive very quickly. That's where Rula comes in. Rula makes that difficult problem simple. They partner with more than 100 insurance plans, making your average cost just $15 a session. That's real therapy from a licensed professional at a price that's reasonable. One of the best things about Rula is that they have a plan to connect you with the right therapist, someone you feel comfortable with based on your needs. Appointments are available as soon as tomorrow. If you're interested, go to rula.com/OTCpod to get started. That's rula.com/OTCpod for quality therapy that's covered by insurance. Go to RULA.com/OTCpod today. While homicide investigators continued to process the bloodstained bookstore, Earl Black was trying to find the courage to tell his daughter that her mother had been murdered.
All I remember is wasn't a call I wanted to make.
Sherry's daughter, Heidi Miller.
I picked up the phone and he said, "Somebody's killed your mother." It was just surreal.
Heidi raced to the bookstore, which was just steps from her parents' home. She still remembers the chaotic scene she witnessed when she arrived.
It was just a huge, awful crime scene. They had all the yellow tape up and just police cars everywhere, and it was just mayhem.
Heidi stood amidst the chaos, unable to process what she had lost. Her mother was her best friend.
She was just my person. I would call her every day. She was thoughtful and forgiving and just a beautiful person. I didn't think I was going to get emotional.
Sherry taught her daughter to follow her dreams and practiced what she preached.
When she was 40, she went back to ballet school and she started college when I started college and graduated. She was wonderful.
Sherry was a dedicated mother and grandmother who built a life with her childhood sweetheart, Earl Black.
We were together most of the time, lived and worked together, so it was a different life for most people.
They had a great marriage. They just spent a lot of time together, and they grew closer and closer over the years. They really enjoyed each other.
The couple supported each other's dreams. Sherry was a self-proclaimed bookworm.
She always loved books. When we first got together, she always told me about going to the library as a child. She wanted a big library of her own.
She started collecting books and soon amassed her own library in their house.
No matter where you look, there was a book. And with all the books that she had, there was always something you could pick up and just get lost in it, you know, so she turned me on to books and never been sorry.
And Sherry slowly expanded that library. But soon, her collection of books outgrew the couple's home and spilled into the building where Earl ran his pool table business.
They started out having a billiard company, and over the years, that kind of took a backseat to my mom's book collecting.
Sherry was a natural at finding rare gems that were in high demand.
She just got really good at knowing what books were collectible and what was valuable, and she had amassed this huge collection of books.
She studied hard to learn what to look for. She was good at about anything she did. She was a very smart lady.
The business began taking off, and before long, it became a family affair.
My dad would package up the books that they had sold and help her ship them out, and then they would go find books together and go on road trips where they would stop at bookstores, and they just worked really well together as a team.
It's always a lot of work. She was the organizer, kept track of stuff, but she did her thing, I did my thing, and we always tried to help each other.
No one could begin to understand why anyone would want to hurt Sherry.
I can honestly say nobody ever came to mind. I never had any idea of who could have done this because she got along with everybody. She didn't have enemies. I could not imagine anybody that could do this. I don't think I ever had any suspicions about anybody.
Detective Darren Carr.
She was this stellar lady, all-American mom, grandma, just everyone loved her.
That was the hard part. Why would somebody do something that vicious and ugly?
The medical examiner's report added more painful details. Detective Ben Pender.
She was stabbed multiple times in the head, the neck, the torso. She was actually stabbed a total of 15 times.
The autopsy also confirmed that she had been sexually assaulted. Lieutenant Dwayne Roof.
We recovered biological evidence from her body.
Investigators focused on the test results from the blood samples they had collected. They believed it was likely that some of the blood had belonged to her killer.
There were several books with blood spatter on it. However, the evidence that really helped was the evidence the suspect left behind leading into that back room.
The same DNA profile was discovered on other evidence found in the store, including the oddly placed Armani belt police discovered.
We were able to secure DNA from that belt.
Detective Joe Cetera.
There were three separate sources of DNA that came to a single male source.
As detectives compiled a list of potential suspects who could be connected to that DNA, police canvassed the area around the bookstore, hoping to find a witness. And it wasn't long before a neighbor reported seeing a suspicious man fleeing the area on the morning that Sherry was killed.
We had one significant lead about an African-American male that was running away from the bookstore that morning.
He disappeared into a neighborhood.
The witness accounts were vague, and no one actually saw the man again after he vanished from the neighborhood. Detectives quickly turned their attention to Sherry's last known movements and discovered that her husband, Earl, had been the last one to see her alive. Investigators immediately began questioning her distraught husband. Consumed with grief, he realized they were considering him a potential suspect in his wife's murder.
If you watch shows, you realize that their first suspect is the husband. But knowing where I had been, what I was doing, I wasn't at all worried about proving it wasn't me.
Detectives wanted to create a timeline of Earl's movements prior to finding his wife's body.
Obviously, with an investigation like this, we have to rule out Mr. Black, the husband. So his timeline became important.
He started by telling them about the last time he saw Sherry alive.
When I walked out the door that morning to go on a job.
Earl told police he left his home around 9:20 that morning.
I saw pool tables and install them and service them. I was going out to a guy's place to set up his pool table.
A camera up the road from the store helped confirm Earl's account.
In this video, you can see Earl's truck leaving, so it helped solidify his alibi.
At approximately 1:18, Earl's truck is seen returning back to the bookstore. Earl's client also verified his timeline.
There's no doubt that he left and returned and did what he said he did.
Once Earl was cleared, police asked him about how Sherry's morning had likely begun. He said Sherry usually opened the shop around 10 o'clock.
Sherry would wake up, walk over to her shop, which was just right next door to her house.
Sherry was often working in her store alone, and that morning had been no different.
I guess you just trust people. You do worry, but not a lot. You know, we hadn't had enough experiences to really worry about it. There's some weirdos that did come in. She ran a few people out of there.
As Earl spoke with police, he recalled something that became a critical lead. He claimed that Sherry had been expecting a client that morning.
She had made arrangements for a gentleman, another rare book dealer, to meet later that morning.
The meeting was set for 10 a.m., and that raised a chilling question. Could a dispute over a rare book have ended in murder? Investigators were able to track down the customer Sherry Black was expecting that morning. But when they questioned him, he was adamant that he had never met up with Sherry that day.
He was coming up to do a book deal. They had done previous transactions.
He then got caught up in traffic and contacted her to tell her that he was going to be late.
The customer said his short conversation with Sherry had taken place just before 10 that morning. A little more than 30 minutes later, he walked into the bookstore.
He arrived, went in, found that she wasn't there. And according to him, he tried a number of times to contact her and was unsuccessful. Then he just sat and waited. He said he was there for 40, 45 minutes.
The customer said he finally got frustrated and left. Investigators were suspicious. They wondered how he could have spent almost an hour in the bookstore after Sherry had been killed and not have noticed any signs of the frenzied attack.
What seemed to be confusing to us is that he didn't see anything or have a sense that anything occurred there.
Even though most of the blood evidence was in the back room of the store, there was some blood in the front of the store as well.
In the area that he said he waited in, we had a couple of small areas of blood evidence. If you were paying attention to your surroundings, you could have probably noticed the blood.
Specifically, there was one glaring blood stain that seemed hard to miss.
There was a big bloody handprint that had been right by the doorknob.
Police were also suspicious of the man's claim that he had never checked the back part of the store during the time he was waiting for Sherry.
The owner whom he's scheduled to meet is not there. He's a return customer, and if he's truly trying to find Sherry, I would think that he would walk into that back room. And according to him, that did not happen.
Nothing, he said, made sense to investigators. His story put him directly in the crosshairs of the investigation.
100% he was a suspect.
Investigators considered whether a dispute over one of those books could have triggered the attack. Some of the rare books were worth a good amount of money.
She had some initial editions of what we call the Book of Mormon. Those would be very valuable, thousands of dollars for one book.
Concern that one of those books might have been the motive for the crime led police to try to set up a second interview with the customer. Detective Joe Cetera.
I was the one who called this guy And I said, hey, this is important. We have more questions. And he said, you know what? I'm going to call you back. Never called me back.
In fact, police got word the customer was no longer talking and had hired a lawyer.
It was frustrating. He's just put another barrier between us and him and the investigation.
But the investigator's thinking began to change when the man and his lawyer agreed to sit down with them. He told investigators he had never looked at the books in the back of the store.
That room was filled with fiction, and he was a rare book dealer and wouldn't have been interested in those kind of things.
And that story became more plausible as police studied the store's design. The door to the back room was not clearly visible from the front of the store.
This door to the back room basically matched the wall. It had the same paneling as the wall, was painted the same.
99% of this crime and the evidence is in that back room.
He said, sorry, he didn't know it existed.
As the interview progressed, the investigator's questions became less pointed, and the customer became more helpful.
All of a sudden, was cooperative, brought all this corroborative evidence of where he had been and what he had been doing that whole day.
He provided the clothing that he was wearing on that day, a DNA sample, a written statement.
And most importantly, the palm print he provided was not a match to the ones found at the crime scene.
We were very easily able to eliminate him as a suspect.
Once he was cleared, his story dramatically narrowed the time frame in which the attack had taken place.
It was a 30-minute time frame right before 10 o'clock to 10:30.
The hard work investigators had done to eliminate all the potential suspects with direct connection to Sherry led them to a troubling realization. The beloved bookstore owner had been killed by a stranger, and those types of crimes were the most difficult to solve.
One of my worst fears was that he's going to do this again. And if he does it again, he's going to get better and harder to find. We had a murder on the loose.
More on The Case, the podcast, after this.
Why have I asked my electrician I found on Angie.com to bury my pet hamster Nibbles in our yard for me? Because I was so moved by how carefully he buried my electrical wires, I knew I could trust him to bury my sweet Nibbles after his untimely end. Nibbles. Gone too soon. May he scurry in peace.
Hey, sorry about your pet, but I just wire stuff.
Nibbles would have loved you like a brother.
Connecting homeowners with skilled pros for over 30 years. Angie, the one you trust to find the ones you trust. Find pros for all your home projects at Angie.com.
Sherry Black's unsolved murder had police braced for the worst. And the pressure to track him down before he killed again was intense. Detective Darren Carr.
We all felt pressure because if Sherry could be a victim, literally anyone in the community could have been a victim.
Detective Joe Cetera.
I was concerned that we would see this person commit a similar crime again. Time was ticking.
There was a sense of fear in the community. Sherry's daughter, Heidi Miller.
Anybody that could do what he had done to my mom, you needed to get that person off the street.
And less than 3 weeks later, it appeared the worst had happened when police were called to the scene of another shocking crime. Lieutenant Dwayne Roof.
Roughly 18 days later, there was yet another brutal homicide.
The lifeless body of 45-year-old Christine Gable was found in the women's bathroom of Fairmont Park. It was just a few miles from Sherry's bookstore.
It's important to note that these type of brutal murders just don't happen often in the Salt Lake area. To have two within an 18-day period, boy, we really wanted to do whatever we could to support that investigation.
Detectives noted the similarities between Sherry's murder and the Fairmont Park killing.
Both of them females, close in time and proximity.
The level of brutality that both females were killed with.
They were both obviously sexually motivated crimes.
But there was also one key difference between the two attacks. The prime suspect in Christine Gable's murder had already been arrested.
His name was Paul David Vara.
Investigators believe that Sherry's killer might be the man already in custody.
We compared notes, and I was like, this is our guy. This has to be our guy.
But when detectives reviewed Vara's extensive police record, they made a shocking discovery.
We determined that he had been in jail when our crime occurred. I was really surprised.
Vara had been released from police custody several days after the attack in the bookstore. Although Vara was responsible for the murder in the park, he could not have been Sherry's killer.
It hit me hard that that wasn't our suspect, because we all had high hopes that we can solve the case, we can bring justice to the Black family, we can tell the community in general that, hey, we've found our guy.
Instead, it became clear the message would be far more troubling.
I was like, there's two guys that are capable of that in this area. Maybe Salt Lake isn't so safe.
It was a massive setback for the investigation, but detectives weren't giving up. They hit the streets again, looking for a clue or a witness they had missed.
It's common that a crime like this is committed by somebody that either lives or works within a mile radius. So we did a lot of canvassing.
But despite all their hard work and months of searching, the investigation had stalled.
This case was probably the most high-profile murder in Utah. And every time we've looked at somebody, it really turned into a dead end.
For Sherry's family, life was never the same after her murder. Earl moved out of the home that he and Sherry had lived in for more than 25 years. Sherry's daughter, Heidi Miller.
From the day she died, we took him home to live with us. He never lived in his home again after that. It was just too traumatic and lonely, and awful things had happened there. So we just scooped him up and took him home with us, and he just became part of our live-in family.
As the years passed, the family found it hard to remain optimistic that Sherry's killer would ever be caught. But they refused to let anyone forget about her case.
I always felt like as long as the case was being worked on, I could live with a no solve. But when times were slow and we weren't getting any information, it was unbearable. So we just kept pushing and pushing.
As time goes on, you start to worry, question, wonder, and you just rack your brain. Who do I know that it might have been?
With no viable leads, Sherry Black's loved ones remain committed to finding her killer.
We're going to get you. Sooner or later, we're going to get you.
Deputy DA Zozo Collins.
I have never met a victim's family that is that involved.
This case, it never left our consciousness.
But 8 years after the crime, police were still no closer to solving it than they were on the morning of Sherry's murder. Prosecutor Josh Graves.
This was a true mystery, and it just baffled a lot of the investigators.
You have to work with what you have. We worked tirelessly with the Utah Bureau of Forensic Services in helping us to understand what could we do with this suspect DNA.
There were no matches in CODIS nor any of the other DNA databases. But lead detective Ben Pender and the rest of the team were undaunted.
He would have all these leads he had run down and the work that he was doing.
He was all over, doing everything, just completely relentless.
Detective Pender focused on forensic genealogy and spent years narrowing down family trees until there was just one name left on his list.
His persistence and the science came through for him.
Detective Ben Pender.
We were able to come up with a name of an individual. Adam Antonio Durbero.
Adam Durbero was not your typical suspect. The 29-year-old was just 19 at the time of Sherry's murder. And his name had never appeared in the case file.
This is someone that had no ties to Sherry. This was a true, complete stranger that had done this crime. No one ever brought him up. He somehow managed to fly under the radar.
I started doing research on him. As an adult, he only had 2 shoplifting citations. He went from the age of 19 without committing any violent felonies.
And that meant investigators had to obtain a sample of Durbero's DNA to compare to the evidence at the crime scene. Undercover officers trailed their suspect until he gave them what they needed.
He was eating some fast food, and they saw him throw the bag away.
He disregarded his DNA in a public setting. We were able to take that DNA to our state crime lab.
Just 10 hours later, Detective Pender received the test results.
We got a text from the scientist who said it's a match.
It was the critical evidence that police needed to arrest Durbero. As he was taken into custody, his defeated reaction spoke volumes.
I believe he has been looking over his shoulder for the last 10 years.
On the Case, the podcast will continue in a moment.
Don't you wish everything was more rewarding? With Rakuten, almost everything is. You can earn cash back on those new shoes you've been wanting. You can save on the next trip you book. You can cash in on groceries. Just join, shop your favorite brands, and save. Target, Instacart, Expedia, Macy's, Sephora, CVS, the list is long. Save online, in-store, and at over 22,000 restaurants. And when it's time to redeem those rewards, get your money exactly how you want it. Choose PayPal, check, Bilt points, or cash out with gift cards. Eligible American Express card members can choose to earn membership rewards points instead of cash back. Terms and conditions apply. So go ahead, take a trip, fill a cart, order dessert. Rakuten is a world of rewards. Join today for free. Go to Rakuten.com or get the Rakuten app. That's Rakuten.
Detective Pender took a unique approach with Durbero in the interrogation room.
I just went in there and said, listen, I'm not going to ask any questions. You're here for the Sherry Black homicide that occurred in November 30th of 2010. This family's been waiting for answers for years.
Durbaro's response was stunning.
I probably shouldn't say this to the lawyer, but honestly, it's just plain they do need to know. I went into that store, and I had no intention at all to do anything. It had been a rough week, and I just was so angry.
But Durbaro claimed he wasn't angry at Sherry Black. He was furious about his life in the state's foster care system.
I was just going to be another number in the system.
He had indicated to me that he was transferred to this other home that very day.
In fact, Durbaro only went to the bookstore that morning while waiting for an appointment to talk with a therapist about his problems.
He had some extra time and decided he would go and take a look at the books.
Once inside, he noticed that he was the only customer. And then he met the owner, Sherry.
He said Sherry was there to greet him.
And for some unknown reason, Sherry's kind greeting set him off.
She smiled and turned away. And there was just a pair of scissors nearby. And I picked them up and I hit her.
When you're hitting her with the scissors, can you kind of describe that to me?
Durbaro then gave a chilling demonstration of what happened.
So is the handle of the scissors in your hands?
Yeah.
The sudden and gruesome confession was shocking, and so was Durbaro's motive.
Why her? Why Sherry?
I don't know, man. I don't know. I think it was just her being kind, honestly.
As Durbaro spoke, the seasoned investigator had to try and push his emotions aside. The details were hard to listen to.
Just heartbreak. She had to endure that all because of being nice to somebody.
Durbaro said after killing Sherry, he fled from the store and ran to a scheduled therapy session.
I just ran. I didn't stop until I got to my therapist's office. I didn't realize what I had done until I was in the bathroom just scrubbing.
No one in the therapist's office remembers seeing any evidence that the teenager had just committed a murder. Durbaro said afterwards, he put the attack out of his mind.
Honestly, I just tried to pretend that it wasn't me. It's a mistake that I wish every day that I had never, ever made. I was young. I was stupid. I was so angry. It wasn't personal. It wasn't planned. Me talking about this. My life as it is, I'm sober.
Detectives felt no sympathy for the confessed killer. Durbaro's gruesome act of violence had already destroyed many lives, and his version of why he committed the crime was hard for anyone to understand.
It made no sense as far as the crime that he committed. I think he had a very troubled youth, but it doesn't allow you to do what he did.
After Durbaro was charged with aggravated murder, Sherry's family was given the answers they had waited more than a decade to hear. Sherry's daughter, Heidi Miller.
That was a crazy day. I was with my girlfriend and got the call that Ben wanted to see us at the police headquarters. And then he called my dad and my husband, who were hunting in Idaho, and told them that he needed to meet with them. And so we had a pretty good idea.
Earl Black will never forget that moment.
Just being overjoyed that they found the guy. Just such a relief. Takes you a while to sit and think about that. Just so glad to have that person off the street, you know, not knowing what else he's done or had in mind, but just getting him gone.
You wonder what that day's going to be like for so long and how you're going to feel when you get that news. It was just surreal.
But their relief was tempered with puzzlement.
You're still just numb. Can't really believe it. It's hard to imagine a 19-year-old in that state.
We had met with some profilers early on, and they had said the person that did this will have been probably a teenager, really young, and it was hard to believe that. I didn't believe it. And so to find out that he was 19 when it happened was kind of overwhelming that a person that young could do something so violent.
Following Durbaro's confession, prosecutors and Sherry's family had a difficult decision about how to proceed with the case. Prosecutor Josh Graves.
His age at the time was certainly a factor that we had to consider when deciding, was this a case that was one we should pursue the death penalty on?
Durbaro agreed to plead guilty to avoid a death sentence. The judge ultimately decided on life without the possibility of parole. Sherry's family had mixed emotions during the sentencing.
It was overwhelming. I feel sad for him. I really do. Anybody that could do that is beyond troubled, but I just felt like he needed to be in prison for the rest of his life.
Following Durbaro's conviction, Sherry's family tried to turn their pain into something positive.
They created a Sherry Black Foundation, so they're actually paying it forward and trying to help others.
The foundation provides resources and assistance to law enforcement and cold case teams across the country.
My heart breaks for families who don't have answers, who don't have hope. It's providing hope.
Heidi feels the work is a fitting way to honor her mother.
The way she taught me to be kind and thoughtful and strong and independent. She was just a wonderful woman who worked hard and wanted to do good and make a difference and loved her family so much. And she was just a great example to all of us. Her courage gave me courage. It's inspired me to work hard and to not let her murder be in vain, to make something good out of something that was so terrible.
Earl Black tries to focus on all the joy he and Sherry experienced rather than everything he lost that tragic day. But it's a difficult battle.
Big piece of my life was taken away. It's hard because he took so much away. We'll never be over it. She was so good. Super person.
For more information on the Sherry Black Foundation and how you can help, please visit their website at sherryblackfoundation.org. Thanks for listening. Please don't forget to follow, rate, and review. And if you want more information on today's case, visit facebook.com/paulazanofficial or just click the link in the episode description. I'm Paula Zahn. Please join us again next Wednesday when we're back on the case, the podcast.